All right, welcome everyone to part two of our lecture series on Can Anger Be Righteous? For those in the physical room, apologies that the room is a bit colder than we would like. As you can tell, our heat is not working. But perhaps as an exercise in feeling some discomfort that might lead to anger, and then we can work that through. I want to begin with a quick review of what we talked about last week. We saw a number of sources, and we could have seen many, many more, describing the ways in which the rabbis, the classical rabbis of the Talmud, describe anger as a terrible thing, the worst thing, something that cannot be accepted in any way, shape, or form. In one formulation, anyone who gets angry, Gehinnom, hell, rules over them. And we see that reach its peak in the Rambam, who normally says that every personality trait we should strive to have in the middle, but anger is one of two exceptions to that rule, where we should absolutely have no anger whatsoever, be completely free of that emotion. And we saw that one way of understanding this negativity is by attending to the question of productivity, right? Or more accurately, counterproductivity. Because anger leads us to make bad decisions. It leads us to sort of be unclear. We can't teach when we're angry. Students can't learn from us when we're angry. For all of those reasons, anger is therefore a terrible thing. But if you get focused on productivity or counterproductivity, well, then the other side can equally come out, right? Because we can see that there are ways in which anger can be productive. We spoke about thinkers from Aristotle to civil rights activists in the 20th century using anger as something that actually can accomplish something. And that might lead to the Rambam contradicting himself, saying in not one but two places that there are times when you should get angry because it actually will lead to a better outcome, right? My anger will teach you not to do that negative thing that you are doing. It will help my students be better students. And finally, I argued that contradiction in that Rambam, though fundamentally a contradiction, maybe one way of understanding that is by thinking about anger as something that can be useful and therefore perhaps sometimes is even necessary, and nonetheless something that exerts a cost on your soul, a negative trait, and therefore it is still negative, even as it might at times be essential. Today we're going to shift gears a bit. We're going to actually focus on one longer text, a sugya, an extended passage from the Talmud, that while officially about the laws of the Sabbath, is really, as we will see, at least equally, if not really, about anger. We're going to see in this sugya, like we saw last week, productivity as a major theme. Is your anger productive or not? But we're also going to see a number of problems in this passage, in this sugya. And as we think through those problems and try to figure out how can we try to resolve or at least understand these problems that come up in the sugya, we'll start to see some other aspects of anger come up. And in the process, we'll start to think in different ways about how we might relate to feeling our anger, expressing our anger, and feeling that way. So without further ado, everyone in the room has the hard copy of the source sheets. If you are on the online version, you have it available in the folder. So we're going to start with the source number one. This is an extended passage from the Talmud. And I like to tell folks, if you are not familiar with Talmudic learning, you may have sort of heard about the Talmud as a difficult text. I, in general, am not one of those advocates. I think the Talmud gets a sort of inaccurate rap. It is a text that almost anyone who wants to learn it with the right scaffolding and the right handholding can actually learn. If you are interested in that, talk to me. I'm eager to find ways for you to learn at Hadar to find that the Talmud is not as intimidating a text as you think it might be. But our example tonight is a bad example of that, because this is actually a very difficult text, even by the standards of the Talmud. So if you are new to Talmud and this text scares you off, you should know that this is an atypical text. It is a particularly difficult one. So without further ado, source number one. We begin with a Mishnah, a text from around the year 220 CE. Hakoreh b'chamaso, v'almeso, v'chol makalkalin, peturin. Anyone who tears, and the implied object here is your clothing, right? You tear your clothing in your rage or for your deceased loved one. Anything that is destructive, you are exempt. So the rabbis in the realm of Shabbos law talk about three categories of things you could do. You could do something that is allowed, it's mutar. You could do something that is forbidden, and it's such a core violation of Shabbos that if you do that thing on Shabbos, you have truly violated it, and you are culpable, you get punished. If you did it accidentally, you have to bring a sacrifice to the temple. But in between those two extremes are things that are forbidden, but they're not so problematic that you actually get punished for them, right? It's the difference between driving 5 miles over the speed limit, which is against the law, but you're not going to get a ticket most likely, or driving 20 miles over the speed limit when you'll actually be culpable. So this Mishnah tells us that if you tear your clothes in a state of rage, implied here, because that is destructive, you shouldn't have done it. You're still not allowed to do that, but it's not a core violation of Shabbos. You're not held accountable. There's no punishment for that. And the idea here is that fundamentally, the rabbis are concerned with productive acts on Shabbos. When we're trying to create the Sabbath, we're trying to create a day in which we're not engaged in productive labor. And so when I take my shirt and I'm so mad at you that I rip it, well, that was destructive, right? I had a nice shirt and now I have rags. So even though I shouldn't have done that anyway, it is considered exempt. I'm not punishable for that act of tearing on Shabbos. That's what the Mishnah says. The Gemara, the Talmud on this, comes along and brings It brings an equally authoritative source, a text not from the Mishnah, but from the same time period as the Mishnah, and therefore of equal authority, which says, HaKorea bechamaso, uv evlo, v'almeso, chayev, someone who tears their clothing in their rage, or again, in a case of mourning. We're not going to talk about that mourning piece, but I'm sure many folks, probably most folks, are familiar with the practice of when an immediate relative dies, tearing one's clothing as a sign of one's grief. So if one tears in any of these cases, Chayev, you are actually held accountable for breaking Shabbos. V'afal pishim mechalelas haShabbos yatzei yedei kriya. And even though you violated Shabbos, if in the case of mourning, you did that, if you found out that, God forbid, your loved one had died on Shabbos and you tore your clothing, you would be held accountable and you would have fulfilled your obligation in tearing. We're obviously going to focus on the anger piece, even though the avelut piece, the mourning piece, is also extremely interesting here. So the Gemara brings this as an objection. And you can see the objection straightforwardly, right? One text says, well, if I tear in my rage, I'm exempt from punishment because that was a fundamentally destructive act. The other source says, if I tear in my rage, I'm held accountable, even though it was a destructive act. The Gemara cannot handle such a contradiction, and so it tries to resolve them. In the ellipsis, it resolves the two texts vis-a-vis the laws of mourning. And now we pick up with where it says in English, it is resolved. Tenach, meso, ela chamaso, achamaso, kasha. Okay, so you just resolved in the part that I skipped over, the contradiction between the two laws of mourning, but what about the case of tearing in rage? How can it be that one text says, if I tear in my rage, I am exempt from punishment, and the other text says, if I tear in my rage, I am held accountable? Chamaso achamaso nami la kasha. The case of tearing in rage is also not a contradiction. We can resolve these two texts. How so? Ha Rabbi Yehuda, ha Rabbi Shimon. One of these texts was authored by the rabbi Rabbi Yehuda. The other was authored by Rabbi Shimon. And as we'll see in a moment, these two rabbis have a debate about a core principle of Shabbos law. And if you know that debate, you can easily explain why one of these texts would say, Chayiv, you're held accountable for tearing on Shabbos. And the other one would say, exempt, you're exempt for tearing on Shabbos. What's that debate? Ha Rabbi Yehuda, and this is the part where, if you're not familiar with Talmudic learning, it can go off the rails, but this is also the least important part to understanding what we're going to be caring about tonight. Ha Rabbi Yehuda, de Amar Malacha She'ein Tzricha Legufa Chayav Aleha. Right, so one text, the text that says you are held accountable. If I tear in my rage, I am culpable for having broken Shabbos. That text follows the view of Rabbi Yehuda, who says that a Malacha She'ein Tzricha Legufa, which I would translate literally as a labor that is not needed for itself. I'll explain in a moment what that means. In such a case, you are held accountable, and therefore this act of tearing in my rage would seem to be fall in that category, and so Rabbi Yehuda would say, I'm held accountable, I am punished for my violation. Ha Rabbi Shimon de'amar, malacha she'ein tzricha legufa, pater aleha. And the Mishnah, which says, I'm exempt from punishment, that's Rabbi Shimon, who says, in any case of this legal category of malacha she'ein tzricha legufa, I'm exempt. Now, what is malacha she'ein tzricha legufa? I'm going to explain it. If you get it, great. If you don't worry about it, because the next line, this is really the setup, it's the next line that we really care about. Malacha she'ein tzricha legufa is I do a labor, but I'm not doing it for the sort of product of that labor. So a relevant example here would be, if I have a piece of fabric, it's a big piece of fabric, and I want to make two shirts out of it. So I tear that fabric into two pieces of fabric, and now I have two pieces of fabric out of which I can make two shirts. That is tzricha legufa. I did that act of labor for its product. As opposed to, if I tore it, oh, I don't know, because I'm mad, right? I didn't want the product of my labor. I just did that act that resulted in two pieces of fabric, but that's not why I did it. That's ein tzricha legufa. And so the idea is that I'm not doing that labor for its sort of core, normal result. In that category, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon disagree. Rabbi Yehuda says you are still culpable. Rabbi Shimon says you are exempt. We can line that up with our Mishnah and our other text. The one that says you're exempt says, oh yeah, that's following Rabbi Shimon, because he didn't want two pieces of fabric, he just wanted to let out your rage. The other one says, no, even when you didn't want the product of your labor, you're still held accountable. This is all very technical, and to my mind, teaches us nothing about anger. So if that was overly technical, don't worry about it. But what you need to know is that this is going to set up the next part, which is that we now say, Amar d'shmasle Rabbi Yehuda b'mesaken b'mekalkel mishmasle. Okay, granted, Rabbi Yehuda is strict in this category, again, that you may or may not have understood, of malacha she'en yirtzich laguf. I get that he's stringent in that case. But is he stringent even when the act is destructive? Right? That is to say, maybe I, you know, if I, what's a good example of this? Well, this is going to sound a little counterintuitive, but for the, according to the rabbis, the reason why you normally dig a hole is not to have a hole in the ground, is to get dirt, right? So the desired product of your labor is the dirt. What if I dug a hole in order to make a swimming pool? That would not be destructive, because I now have something, my land is more valuable, I can make a swimming pool there, but it would be enes richa legufa. So would Rabbi Yehuda say, even in a case where it's destructive, even then you're held accountable, right? Which is exactly what's happening when I tear in my rage. When I tear in my rage, not only do I not want the two halves of the piece of fabric in order to make two shirts out of them, it was actually destructive. I had a nice shirt, and now I've got two rags. My sort of overall utility went down. And in such a case where something is that, where an act is actually destructive, the idea here is that even Rabbi Yehuda should be lenient. And if that's the case, then I can't resolve my problems. Remember, the original problem is, one text says I tear in my rage, that's a core violation of Shabbos, I'm held accountable. Another text says I tear in my rage, that's not a core violation because it's destructive. We try to assign them to Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, and now we're saying you can't really do that because even Rabbi Yehuda would be lenient since it's a destructive act. All right, the core idea here is when you're destructive, when you're making the world worse, that's not a core violation of Shabbos because Shabbos is about avoiding improving the world. It's about imagining the world as already so perfect that you don't need to improve it anymore. So now we need to resolve it another way. Page 2. Amar Rabbi Abin, Hai Nami Misaken Hu, this act of tearing a shirt in my rage, even though it looks to, you know, most economists like a destructive act, because I start with a shirt that's worth however many dollars, and I end with two rags, it looks destructive, it's actually constructive, it's actually productive. Why? Deka'avid nachas ruach leyitzro. Because the person tearing the shirt in their rage gives pleasure to their yetzer. Yetzer literally means inclination. In rabbinic literature, when you have that word yetzer on its own, it is always shorthand for the yetzer hara, the evil inclination. So why is it productive to tear my shirt in my rage? Because when I tear my shirt in my rage, I get so mad that I just rip it open, like the Hulk, right? When I do that, I give pleasure to my yetzer hara, and therefore it's productive. Now the Gemara says, V'chi hai gavna mishare? Doing that, tearing in your rage, is that actually even allowed? Not on Shabbos now, right? Now we're saying in general, are you even allowed? You're telling me it's productive because it gives pleasure to my yetzer. Is that ever allowed? V'hatanya, don't we have a text that says, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, this other rabbi, he has the same name, but he's a different rabbi. Rabbi Shimon, the son of Elazar, says, Mishum Chilfa Bar Igra, in the name of Chalafta Bar Agra, Shamar Mishum Rabbi Yochanan Ben Nuri, so the name of Rabbi Yochanan Ben Nuri. HaMekareya Begadav Bechamaso, someone who tears their clothes in their rage. VeHamishaber Keilav Bechamaso, and someone who throws dishes and breaks them in their rage. VeMifazer Ma'osav Bechamaso, and someone who takes coins and throws them, you know, throws them across the room in their rage. Yehei Beinecha Ka'oved Avodah Zarah, someone who does that, someone who throws a temper tantrum and rips their clothes or breaks dishes or throws coins around, you should view that person as the very worst kind of person in rabbinic Judaism, an idolater. This is the worst insult a rabbi can throw at you. You are an idolater. Shekach omanaso shel yetzer hara. Because this is how the yetzer hara, the evil inclination, works. Hayom omer lo asekach, ulemachar omer lo asekach, ad shomer la avod avodah zarah, velech veoved. How does the yetzer hara work? Today, it says, do this thing that doesn't seem so bad. And then you do it. And then tomorrow it says, well, you know, you did that thing that didn't seem so bad. Let's do one step worse. And you keep getting worse and worse and worse until the Yetzer Hara says to you, go and worship Zeus. And you're like, all right, that doesn't seem bridged too far anymore. So something about tearing in your rage is a pathway towards the worst thing the rabbis can imagine, or to be fair, one of the three worst things the rabbis can imagine, idolatry. Amar Rabbi Abin, Rabbi Abban comes along and says, Maikra, what's the verse that supports this idea? Lo yevacha el zar, velo sishtachavel el nechar. There's a verse that says there should be no foreign god in you, which really means among you, but literally, there should be no foreign god in you, and don't bow down to a foreign god. Ezu is el zar sheyesh begufa shel adam. Who is the foreign god that is in each and every person? Right, because it says don't bow down to the god that's in you. There shouldn't be a foreign god in you. Who is that? Havi omer ze yetzer hara. The foreign god that lives in each and every one of us is the evil inclination, and therefore when I give in to my evil inclination, it's as if I am worshiping idolatry. Okay, so now we got an objection, right? You told me that that this act of tearing in my rage is productive. That's why Rabbi Yehuda would hold me accountable for it. It's productive because I give pleasure to my Yetzer Hara, but I've got this other text that says actually giving into my rage, that's the worst thing I can do. I won't say more than that for now, so we need a new resolution. Lo tzricha, right? We actually, what's the case where we would say that you are actually held accountable for tearing on Shabbos? Deka'avid lamirma emasa inche beise. The idea that you'd be held accountable, that your act of tearing in your rage on Shabbos is so productive, such that you're held accountable for breaking Shabbos, what is that case? That's the case where you do it in order to instill fear on the members of your household. Ki hada Rav Yehuda shalif mitzavyasa, like Rav Yehuda who would pull the threads of his clothes, i.e. tearing his clothes. Rav Acha bar Yaakov tavar mani tevire, Rav Acha would take broken plates, not good plates, because that would be a violation of don't destroy things unnecessarily. So he'd take broken plates, and then he'd break them more in order to show how angry he was. Rav Sheshet rami le la'amte munine aresha. Rav Sheshet would throw fish brine on the head of his female slave slash servant. So, without further ado, let's jump into some of these other problems that we've raised, and which I think so the sources on the source sheet are going to help us think through, in some cases problematize further, in some cases make more sense of. So, one problem that I heard, actually I did not hear tonight, but I heard it in the comments last week, and I think our passage raises it yet again, is thinking about, is this model of anger as a mode of education and discipline, is that actually a religious ideal? Is that actually something do we believe that? You know, we saw this last week when the Rambam talked about if your students are lazy, you're obligated to be roges, to get angry with them in order to get snap them out of their laziness and help them be better students. And one of the objections was not the Rambam contradicts himself, that was a different objection, but rather, does that really work? Does actually getting angry with your students actually help them to learn? So we have this question of, is anger actually effective? And I want to name that I don't think it's probably obvious to everyone in the room that this is a problem, right? I'm confident, because it was raised last week, that there are people in the room who are like, yeah, you think you're going to help the members of your household, your kids, behave better if you scream at them? That's not effective parenting. That's not going to educate anyone. Folks for whom that's instinctively obvious that that's a problem. There might be other folks in the room who are thinking, no, actually, I've been a student or I've been a teacher in a moment where something was conveyed to me with anger, and precisely because of that, the message stuck. And I also, I personally feel like I'm on both sides of this, right? There are times when I'm like, yeah, people use rage way too often as an educational mode, and it's very often ineffective. And there are times when messages have been conveyed to me that stuck precisely because of the anger. I saw the passion that it evoked in someone I cared about, someone I respected, and it got the message across more clearly. And I will also say, although we'll trouble this in a moment, that I hope as a parent that there have been times when I have express something to my children with anger, where it actually was effective, precisely because of that. You'd have to ask my kids if it actually was, and probably have to ask them in 20 years from now and not now. But I do think, you know, I feel both sides of this question of, is it actually a problem? And so I want to name more clearly, if it is a problem, why is it a problem, right? If we think that this model of instilling fear on the members of your household, or to expand that more widely on the members of your community, right, as a mode of trying to get people to act better, what precisely is it about that bothers some folks so that we can all understand why this is something we have to think about? And one piece of it is what we saw last week in the text, the Orchos Tzadikim. The Orchos Tzadikim said that when you get angry, you shut down questions, right? Why, according to Perkei Avos, can an angry person not be a teacher? Because if I'm an angry teacher, every time you ask a question, I scream at you, "You idiot, why didn't you understand?" Well, then you're not going to ask questions. If you don't ask questions, you're not going to learn. Moreover, if I'm angry, I'm not clear-headed, I won't explain things as clearly as I need to. And moreover, If I'm angry, you're not going to receive what I have to teach. Even if I do teach it clearly, you're going to be so focused on, oh my gosh, Michael is raging, that you're not going to be able to receive that. So we can see this idea that anger can be an ineffective mode of teaching. It's just ineffective. And if that's the case, then what's our sugya doing telling us that it's productive to tear my shirt in rage in order to make the members of my household behave better? And this, I think, is a real tension, right? I don't actually have sources. I didn't find anything that weighed in on this question of when is anger an effective teaching mode and when is it not. We just see this contradiction between some texts like Orchos Tzadikim saying it is not an effective mode, and other texts like the Rambam and like our sugya tonight saying, no, it actually is effective. And I would love during when we get to the Q&A and discussion at the end, if there are folks who have thoughts on this, sort of like explore this further. But for now, I want to leave that as a question, right? What is it that leads some texts to say anger is something that gets in the way of teaching, and other texts to suggest that anger can actually be a powerful and effective mode of education? So that's one aspect of this I want to come back to in the Q&A. The second problem with this, though, is that I think, and I don't just think, I know this because I've done this, that very often, thinking about anger as an effective educational mode, even if it can be, very often we use it as a cover-up. So my kid, I come back to this example every time, leaves a Lego on the floor, I step on it, I get hurt, and I scream at them in rage, right? And why am I actually screaming at them? Because I'm angry, I'm literally hurt in that example, and I want to let it out. It just feels good to let it out. I justify it after the fact by saying, my kid has left Legos on the floor 100 times. Maybe if I yell at them, they'll learn their lesson not to do it, right? But that's not really why I'm yelling. I'm actually yelling because I'm just venting. And then rather than admit that I feel bad about what I did by yelling at my kid, I cover it up by saying, oh, I did it to educate them. I am not saying that that's always the case, right? The first piece of what I was saying was, I think there are times when anger can be effective educationally. But at least in my experience, very often, that notion that it can be effective educationally, I use, and I suspect that I'm not the only one in the room who does, I use as an excuse to justify my rage rather than to work with it. So this problem with anger as an educational mode, this idea that sometimes we might actually be using it to vent our anger rather than to educate, I think actually comes up very clearly, even if implicitly, in source number 3. So we're on page 3 of the source sheet. Source number 3 from our old friend the Rambam. Notice it's Laws of Human Dispositions, chapter 2, paragraph 3. And I point that out because this is the same text that we saw last week. Last week we had this in the ellipsis. Now we're getting what was in the ellipsis. That where the Rambam said, you should never, ever, 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 ever feel rage. Even for something that's appropriate to feel rage about, you should not feel rage. And in the middle of that, he says the following. V'im ratza lahatil eima al banav ubnei veso. If one wanted to instill fear on their children, the members of their household. And if you know both Hebrew and Aramaic, you'll see that the Rambam's language here is basically a direct translation of the end of our sugya. So clearly what the Rambam is about to say is his interpretation of our sugya. Our sugya said, if you want to instill fear on the members of your household, presumably to educate them, that's a productive use of anger. And so now the Rambam, who just told me that I can never get angry, well, what does he do with our sugya that says it's productive to scream at your kids and teach them that way? What's he going to do with that? And he adds, oh, al tzibor, right? Im hayaparnas, v'ratza li'ozal en kedesh yachzru lemutav. Or you wanted to educate the community. You're a communal leader. Let's say you're a congregational rabbi, and your community is doing a terrible job of giving tzedakah. And you've had shiurim, you've had classes about tzedakah, you've met with people individually, you've tried to improve your community's commitment to tzedakah, and they remain cheapskates who won't give anything to tzedakah, right? So what do? Right? You want to get angry with them so that they will learn to be better. He says, Yaretz mo bifnehem shu koes, kedei liyasram. You should present yourself before them as if you are angry. V'tiyeh daitom yusheves beino levein atzmo, ke'adam shu medame koes b'shas ka'asovuhu eino koes. You should show them that you're angry, but you should be totally calm on the inside. You're faking it. You're acting anger. What does it mean to use anger productively? It means not to feel anger. It means to express an anger that you no longer feel. And I presume, because the Rambam knows that people get angry, right? I presume what he means is, if my kid left a Lego on the floor and I want to scream at him for leaving that Lego on the floor, I don't. I stop myself. I wait. And then a minute, 10 minutes, 2 days later, when I'm no longer angry because I've had time to cool off, I go to my kid and I scream, "You left a Lego on the floor. How could you do this?" Right? I present myself as if I am angry, but I'm not actually angry. Now, part of what I think is beautiful, I will say, I love and I hate this Rambam. And I can see from the faces in the room, at least, that some of you at least hate it, and maybe I'm going to get you to love it also. Part of what I love about it is that it's taking this idea of anger and saying, yeah, but like, you can separate the feeling from the expression. I'll come back to that in a moment. I want to start with my skepticism, though. The part that really bothers me here, well, a couple pieces, but one that I want to focus on is, I don't think that's what our sugya means. Right? Our sugya did not say, when is anger productive, when you aren't actually angry, but you just present yourself as if you're angry. And I don't think most of us, if I'd given you the sugya, I did give you the sugya. I mean, I should have asked, I forgot to, right? If I asked you what you think that last part means, I doubt anyone would have said it means fake your anger. Right? It doesn't sound like that's what it's saying. And the Rambam has to read that in because of his commitment to not ever being angry, at least of his commitment in this paragraph, unlike the paragraphs we saw last week. So that's part of what I think is worthy of skepticism. We've already talked about whether this is an effective mode at all, and that piece I think also we can talk more about when we get to the discussion at the end. But the piece I find most intriguing is his ability to sort of separate out the feeling of an emotion, and in this case the feeling of anger specifically, from its expression. And this is actually really important, because when we have political conversations about anger, one of the things that you will often hear people say, and this picks up on what we were talking about last week, when we speak about the productivity or counterproductivity of anger, you can imagine someone saying, you don't have to imagine it, you actually see this in internal debates within the civil rights movement, of course you're angry about the oppression you're feeling. Of course you should feel that anger. No one's telling you not to feel that anger. We're saying that if you speak with that anger, if you express that anger, you're going to set the cause back. It's counterproductive. And so there's a desire to sort of split the feeling of the emotion from the expression of emotion, to which some, at least according to some of the articles I read, a majority of experimental psychiatrists, I'm not an experimental psychiatrist, so I don't want to speak to the consensus of this or not, but from what I saw, many experimental psychiatrists will say, that's actually not accurate, right? Based on sort of cross-cultural analysis, we can sort of talk about the fact that anger and sort of core basic emotions that human beings feel are tied inherently to their expression, right? To feel anger means to express that anger. The Rambam actually takes us in an opposite direction. He says, actually, you can split it, but not in the sense of feeling anger without expressing it, but rather in the sense of expressing anger without feeling it. And that split, I think, is very powerful. We also see it, by the way, in source number 4. This is a testimony about the Virka Rebbe, the first Rebbe of the Virka Hasidim, who, when he felt he needed to scream at his community, he had a special robe that he would put on, right? And I think what this does, the way we have it in the testimony here in source number 4, I think is, you know, it shows how deliberate it is, but it also makes clear to the congregation, like, what he's doing, right? He's not flying off the handle, but he's actually taking the time to say, now I'm going to be in angry mode. This is a deliberate decision, right? And that feels very similar, very much of a piece with the Rambam. Now, I think this question of whether we can separate the feeling of anger from its expression might also be at work in an early Jewish-Christian divide, right? And here I will want to think with you about the interpretation of a verse that you don't have on the source sheets. This is Psalms 4, verse, depending on if you're looking at a Christian or Jewish Bible, verse 4 or 5. Some of you might say this when you go to sleep at night. It's part of the liturgy for bedtime Shema. The verse goes, Rigzu ve'al techata'u. Rigzu and don't sin. And I didn't translate that word rigzu because that's kind of the point. The word rigzu, it's the same root as we saw last week when the Rambam says, sometimes you got to get mad at your students. He said, Chayav lir goz aleihem. You got to get mad at them. Lir goz, rigzu. If you know the Yiddish expression, I'm broiges with you. That's the same word, right? I'm beroges with you. I'm in anger with you, broiges. And so that word can mean anger. In context, it probably means, at least Rashi understands that word to mean, to tremble, right? Tremble and do not sin. In other words, if I'm a trembler, if I'm a God-fearer, if I feel God's presence so acutely that I'm nervous because I feel like God is watching me all the time, then I won't sin. That's how Rashi translates the verse. That's how many modern English translations translate the verse. However, the Septuagint, the early Greek translation of the Bible, does not translate that way, but rather, orgazeste. Be angry and don't sin. Right? Which, again, is a plausible reading of roges. That notion of being angry is in the semantic range of roges. And so the Septuagint understands it to be be angry but don't sin, which itself is a bit unclear. I should also say that verse in the Greek finds its way into Paul's letter to the Ephesians. Paul says the exact same words that we have in the Septuagint, be angry and don't sin. And it seems like, again, it's not totally clear what that would mean, but it seems like what they're saying is, yeah, we understand you're angry. Be angry. But don't let your anger lead you to sinfulness. And that might be more expansive, like we talked about last week, when you're angry, you can't think straight, and so you do things that you know you shouldn't do. But I also imagine this might mean be angry, but without expressing that anger, right? That sinful act is the expression of the anger. And, you know, the Septuagint translation and Paul following in its wake is saying, be angry, we get that, but you're not allowed to express that anger, right? That kind of splitting that some sides of the sort of civil rights movement in the 20th century wanted to articulate. And by the way, some, not just some sides within, but also some critics of the civil rights movement wanted to articulate, saying, yeah, you're allowed to feel your anger, but when you express it, you set the cause back. So that seems to be like an early Christian reading of this verse. But I want to look at source number 5, which is a text I've known about for a long, long time, but which I had never really thought about in this context. So this is from the Talmud from Tractate Brachot, source number 5. Amar le Eliyahu le Rav Yehuda Achua de Rav Sala Chasida, Elijah the prophet, who according to rabbinic tradition never died and therefore shows up randomly on the road and in Batei Midrash and other places. So he shows up and talks to this fairly obscure rabbi, Rav Yehuda, the brother of Rav Sala Chasida, and he says three things. We're only going to care about the first one. Lo tirtach velo techti. Don't get hot-headed. Tirtach, like to boil. Don't get hot-headed. Don't get angry, and you won't sin. And I always thought of this as like a sort of simple, straightforward folk saying from Elijah. You want to know how to be a good person? Don't get angry. But I now wonder if that's actually some kind of response to Paul. I'm not saying that Elijah the prophet, as imagined by the rabbis, had read Paul and was literally responding. But if you imagine a sort of cultural world in which people are arguing about all sorts of things, one of the things they might be arguing about is exactly this question of, can I feel anger and not express it? And the response of Paul would then be, yeah, feel your anger. Of course you feel your anger. But don't let it motivate your actions. Versus Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, saying, you can't do that. You can't feel that anger and then stop short of expressing it. And therefore, what I'm telling you is, figure out how to sublimate that anger. Get rid of that anger. Get rid of that feeling of anger. And then, 1,000 years later, the Rambam comes on the other side. He says, you know what, actually, it's not that you should feel your anger but not express it, like Paul says. And it's not like you shouldn't even feel it or express it, but rather, the expression can be useful, but the feeling is always negative. So a couple of different ways of thinking about how to split that notion of feeling our anger from expressing it. Okay. Ad kan, thinking about the split between expressing and feeling. I want to turn to a different problem, one that Ariella raised, which is, and I think in a different way Sophie raised as well, which is how do we manage the different pieces of our sugya, right? There's so much going on here. Is it productive to tear in my rage because I vent my anger out? Well, then it says that actually I'm never allowed to do that, so am I not allowed to do that, but it is productive, or I'm not allowed to do that, and therefore it's not productive. What's going on? What sort of full picture I would create if I have to make order of this passage, right? If I'm not just reading this passage as literature, but as a source for an ethical and legal system. And so here I want to turn to source number 6, again, the Rambam. Again, this time from the Laws of Shabbos. And we're going to be talking, this is where the Rambam rules exactly what comes out of our sugya. So the Rambam says, source number 6, Aval chovel bechaveiro, af al pishe niskaven lahazik chayev. Someone who injures their fellow, right? So I, Nina, can I use an example? I punch Nina in the nose. Maybe if you'd known what I was going to say, you would have said it was okay to use you as an example. I punch Nina in the nose, God forbid, and she starts bleeding, right? That's important for the example here. Even though I intended to hurt her, i.e., it was a destructive act, right? Nina was a well-healthy person, and now she has a broken nose, God forbid, right? Even though that was a destructive act, and I intended to be destructive, I am held accountable. Why? Mibnei nachas rucho, because of the pleasure of my soul. Notice, he does not say the nachas ruach that I gave to my evil inclination. I think that's an intentional elision there, because I don't think the Rambam likes this idea. We'll come back to this idea that it's positive because I gave pleasure to my yetzer hara. But he says, rather, I gave myself pleasure. Sharei nizkara daito v'shachacha chamaso. Because my mind cooled down and my anger settled. V'harei u'kimisaken. And therefore that settling, that feeling I had of, I was so mad at you, Nina. You said something awful. And I punched you in the nose and now I feel better. That, even though I intended to cause harm to you and therefore it's a destructive act, it's actually a productive act because of what it did for my soul. Charlie, who was bothered by the sort of raising up of the emotional to the sort of claiming that's a productive thing, this ramps that up even more clearly, I think. Right? Even though I didn't need the blood, which was the product of my labor, right? Even though I didn't need it, because it was productive in giving myself pleasure and cooling my mind, therefore it's productive, and therefore I'm culpable on Shabbos, right? Because it's productive, I'm culpable on Shabbos. It's a productive act, says the Rambam. So how does the Rambam read our sugya? It seems like what he's saying is, oh yeah, it's true, you're not allowed to tear things in your anger. That's the pathway to avodah zara, but it is a productive act, right? You know, not a good example, but it's the first one that comes to mind. You know, if I were to eat bacon right now, right? I'm not allowed to do that, but it is going to give me some sustenance, right? It is a productive act, even though I shouldn't do it. Likewise, if I give into my rage and let it out, maybe I'm not allowed to do that. That's how the Rambam sees reading our sugya, but it's productive, right? And I can, if I'm assessing the anger on its own terms, I can say, yeah, I see why there's a good element to it, that it actually does something positive in the world. The Rambam is regularly attacked by the Ravid, and here is one of those places where the Ravid comes along and says, Rambam, you're crazy. If you think that's a disrespectful way to talk about the Rambam, it's not me. This is how the Ravid talks about him all the time, including here. Says the Ravid, this is the last paragraph in the English. How astounding are his words and shocking his sayings. Sharei afilu kriyas begadav. Im lo lahatil ema al anje beso karuhu oved avodah zara. Because even merely tearing my clothes, not the much worse act of punching Nina in the nose, even just tearing my clothes, if I'm not doing it for an explicitly educational purpose, anything other than that, I'm considered an idolater. Right? They say, if I'm doing it just to relieve my tension, my anger, that's no good. I'm an idolater if I do that. V'kol shekhen chovel b'chaveiro l'nekima. And all the more so when I punch someone in a desire for revenge, that's got to be a negative, horrible act. And so the Ravid seems to read the sugya very differently. It's not just forbidden. It's so forbidden because it's the most counterproductive thing you can do. Giving into your rage is the pathway to idolatry. There is no way, shape, or form in which it is allowed, in which it is productive, unless you are very consciously using it in this very narrow way to teach people something about how to be better in the world. But anytime that I let out my rage simply to vent, that is never okay. And we see these two sides here, the Rambam and the Ravid, really sort of debating this. But I want to note, like we talked about last week, both the Rambam and the Ravid are using the language of productivity to decide what they think about anger. For the Rambam, it might be forbidden, but it's still productive, right? And that's what would make it culpable on Shabbos. For the Ravid, the reason why it's forbidden is precisely because it's so counterproductive. Yeah, I might feel good in the moment when I tear my clothes in a fit of rage. It might make me feel better temporarily. But in terms of my soul's long-term well-being, the overall effect is massive counterproductivity. And therefore, this is not in any way, shape, or form a good thing, right? It's not merely forbidden. It is actually completely destructive. That brings us back to the conversation we were having last week about productivity and counterproductivity. And I brought you, just for those of you who either don't remember or weren't here last week, source number 7. Last week I mentioned Malcolm X. This week I'm bringing Audre Lorde, an important black feminist thinker. I believe this essay was written in the early 1970s. As I mentioned it orally last week, The Uses of Anger. She writes, every woman has a well-stocked arsenal of anger, potentially useful against those oppressions, personal and institutional, which brought that anger into being. Focused with precision, it can become a powerful source of energy serving progress and change. And when I speak of change, I do not mean a simple switch of positions or a temporary lessening of tensions, nor the ability to smile or feel good. I'm speaking of a basic and radical alteration in all those assumptions underlining our lives. In other words, if the whole conversation is about productivity, then I can actually turn that conversation on its head and say, I think anger can be quite productive, right? We saw Malcolm X last week, and in a weird way, I'm saying this a little bit to be provocative, but mostly because I think it's true. I think the Rambam here is actually kind of an intellectual bedfellow with Audre Lorde and Malcolm X, right? That is to say that he gets that it can be productive, right? Now, his productive example here is is the pleasure it gives me. And actually, in that sense, even the Ravid is sort of in this line, right? Because even for the Ravid, if I'm doing it, there's a narrower range of possibilities where it is productive, but that range still exists. Where I use my anger to educate, even for the Ravid, that would be productive. So we see this sort of cross-cultural, cross-chronological debate about productivity and counterproductivity. However, I want to sort of turn our attention to a different way of thinking about anger entirely, different from what we've really been focusing on until now with this productive and counterproductive lens. And I want to do that by focusing on one last problem, which we've raised already, namely, why would you, even if you think, right? I imagine if I did a poll of the room, I'm not going to do it right now, but I imagine if I did a poll of the room, we'd get some divide about, do you think it is productive to vent your rage, right? This debate of the Rambam and the Ravid, I suspect there are folks who would be the Rambam fans here and folks who would be Ravid fans here. But even if you think it's a good thing, the formulation that we have in the Talmud, that it's productive because you are giving pleasure to your Yetzer Hara, your evil inclination, that is really bizarre. Why would the rabbis, who spend so much time talking about how terrible the Yetzer Hara is, why would they say it's productive to give it some pleasure? And I want here to think with you based on a manuscript variation that appears in this passage. What do I mean by a manuscript variation? Before the printing press, how would I get a copy of the Talmud? Well, if I was wealthy enough, I would hire a scribe. I'd say, I want a copy of Tractate Shabbat. And that scribe would find a copy of Tractate Shabbat, and then they would copy it by hand, and then I would give them the money, they'd give me my copy, my handwritten copy of Tractate Shabbat. Unlike a printing press, mistakes can seep in. And not only mistakes, but sometimes alternate versions, right? Because in a world where you don't have a printing press, it's the idea that matters more than the literal words. And so you get these sort of alternate versions of passages. And when you get a manuscript variation, sometimes it's just a mistake. The scribe just copied the wrong word, and that's why it varies. And sometimes it reveals an alternate path to thinking about the topic at hand. So look with me at source number 8, which is just a line from source number 1, from our Talmudic passage, but with a manuscript variant. And I sort of marked it in the English with a sort of cross out. Amar Rabbi Abin. Rabbi Abin says, Hai nami misakenhu, right? You told me that Rabbi Yehuda would be lenient here because that's his destructive. No. This act of tearing in my rage is still productive. Why is it productive? Deka'avi nachat ruach liyotzro. Because you are giving pleasure to your yotzer. Not your yetzer, your inclination, but your yotzer, your creator. And the way the scribe did this actually is clear that the text really said yitzro, your inclination, and some scribe, or maybe the original scribe himself, added the vav to make it, instead of yitzro, yotzro. In the English, I crossed out, the other way around. It was originally yotzro, and a scribe crossed out that vav. So you see that someone didn't like that. And I want to be, in the interest of full intellectual integrity, I want to be fully honest with you. Almost certainly, this is an example of a manuscript variant that is just a mistake. Because all the other witnesses have li yitzro, right? That you give pleasure to your evil inclination. And when that's the case, usually something like this is a flub. And moreover, the expression you give pleasure to your yetzer appears nowhere else in rabbinic literature, but the expression you give pleasure to your yotzer appears, I forget what the number is, but something like 12 times. I made that number up right now, but it's in that range. So you can easily see why someone would be like, oh, it says yitzro, that doesn't sound right. It must be the more common phrase yotzro, not inclination, but creator. So almost certainly this is actually a mistake. The scribe sort of slipped and like wrote what he was used to rather than what he actually had in front of him. But even if that's the case, I want to think with you for a moment, because this scribe thought it made sense. So at least someone thought it makes sense to say what really is going on here is when you tear in your rage, you give pleasure to your creator. And I want to think with you about what does it mean? Why would I give pleasure to God when I tear in my rage, right? Not that I'm giving myself pleasure, not that I'm venting, not that I'm keeping the Yetzer Hara at bay by feeding it a little rather than letting it build up steam to the point where it explodes. But there's something about venting my rage that expressing my rage, that actually gives pleasure to God. There's something about that action that makes God say, good for Michael. And I want to suggest that, well, let's turn the page. Source number 5. This is an article by Amir Srinivasan, who is sort of rising star in the world of philosophy. I know nothing about philosophy, but this is what I read about her in the New York Times a couple years ago. This article, The Aptness of Anger, in which she goes through this sort of history of debates about anger and how there's this sort of ongoing productivity, counterproductivity debate, right? But she says there's something else, right? Let's even imagine, let's even concede for the sake of argument that anger is in fact counterproductive. Let's admit that when I tell you something in a loud voice screaming at you, I'm less likely to convince you than if I tell you calmly. Let's concede that point. There's another way to judge anger, which is not its productivity or its counterproductivity, but its aptness. So the first paragraph here, she describes this, right? Is my anger apt? And the second paragraph, when is someone's anger apt? Consider the difference between anger and another similarly negative emotion, disappointment. What makes anger intelligible as anger and distinct from mere disappointment is that anger presents its object as involving a moral violation. Not just a violation of how one wishes things were, but a violation of how things ought to be. If I hurt my foot because there just happens to be a Lego on the floor that's just where it was from the creation, I'm not angry, I'm upset, I'm sad, I'm in pain. If I hurt my foot on the Lego because someone left it out when they were told they should clean up after themselves, right? I'm angry because not only did I suffer pain that I shouldn't have, right? It is someone else's violation that led to my pain. That's the difference between anger, says Srinivasan, and disappointment. So first of all, apt anger, a different way of judging anger, is anger that recognizes an injustice. So then, a couple paragraphs later, she says, what sort of value does an apt response have? I want to suggest that getting angry is a means of effectively registering or appreciating the injustice of the world. Right? When I get angry about an injustice, that's my way of noting the injustice. Most analogous, perhaps, to our capacity for aesthetic appreciation. Just as appreciating the beautiful or the sublime has a value distinct from the value of knowing that something is beautiful or sublime, there's a value to appreciating the injustice of the world through one's apt anger, a value that is distinct from that of simply knowing that the world is unjust. When I read this, I think of, I hope everyone has seen Dead Poets Society. I assume everyone has seen Dead Poets Society. No. Okay. There's a classic scene in Dead Poets Society when you have this iconoclastic English teacher who comes in teaching this sort of very uptight school, and they're reading from this very uptight book about poetry, and he asks one of the students to read the introduction, and the introduction says, we can judge poetry on an XY axis. On the X axis, we can judge its literary effectiveness, on the Y axis, its importance. And some poems will be over here, they're very important, very effective, and others will be down here, and da-da-da, right? A very analytical way of judging poetry. And the point that the teacher, Robin Williams, wants to get across is, that's not how you appreciate poetry. I mean, great, it's great to be able to analyze what are the sort of narrative techniques that the poet used to get across something beautifully. But at the end of the day, there's something different about being able to say like, oh yeah, you know, Schubert uses this technique to like go from one key to the other, and that's very clever, and actually sitting in the concert hall and hearing that Schubert third and being like, oh my God, that just blew my mind, right? There's a difference between those two things. And Srinivasan says the same thing is true with injustice, right? It is true. I can objectively and intellectually say, this thing has happened, it is unjust, and I need to sort of, in as straightforward and emotionless a way as possible, address that injustice. That's actually a good. There is a separate value of feeling that injustice in your kishkas and actually getting angry about it. That, says Srinivasan, is the value of an apt anger, not a productive anger. Even when your anger is counterproductive, there's still value in your anger being apt. There's something it does for you. Now, I will first of all say, as someone who is primarily a utilitarian in the way I think about the world and Jewish texts and law, I find it very hard to stay in this mode. Because for me, it's like, oh, right, because when I really feel it in my kishkas, then I really will work hard to address that injustice, and that gets back to the sort of productive aspect of it. And Srinivasan doesn't want us to go there. She wants us to recognize that just like I, as a musician, instinctively appreciate how great it is to hear a great symphony in a concert hall, even aside from appreciating the sort of artistry there, just feeling that music, in the same way there's something valuable, moral, about being a human being who sees injustice and feels anger. And I think the scribe who wanted us to read this line as, when you feel your anger, when you express your anger, you're giving pleasure to God, well, if God is the arbiter of everything that is fundamentally just and good, then when I, to use the Rambam's language from last week, when I act like a dead one and I don't feel anger over an injustice, well then, there's a way in which I've lost my moral compass. And feeling that anger is actually in some ways essential to being the kind of person God wants us to be. I think it's probably a mistake, but I think the scribe who made that mistake probably had something like that in mind. Or at least for us as readers of that version, that's what comes to us. And so I feel again, you know, in the same way that last week we saw anger can be productive, even as we see all the ways in which it can be counterproductive, even when it's counterproductive, anger can be an apt response to the world, and therefore, I don't know if what I want to say is moral or necessary. I think there's a world of difference between those two, and I can't decide which one I want to use in this moment. And I just want to end by noting this last paragraph in Srinivasan, which I will admit I put out of order. This is actually something she writes earlier in her essay, but I wanted to end here, because I think it's actually an apt way, no pun intended, to end similarly to how we ended last week. She, going back to her discussion of productivity and counterproductivity, she writes, "Prudence recommends against counterproductive anger, for such anger, by definition, is not in the best interest of the oppressed person. But there is perhaps more counting against counterproductive anger than just prudence." That's a very highfalutin way of saying what we've said already many times. Sometimes your anger will get in the way, but there's actually a moral reason not to be angry aside from the counterproductivity, which is insofar as one has a moral duty to care for oneself, a duty of which many are justifiably skeptical, then there might be moral reasons not to get counterproductively angry. That is to say, as I was saying last week about productive anger, and she's saying here about productive anger as well, the angrier I get, the harder that is in my soul. And I think, that that remains true for apt anger as well. It may well be that there are times when we need to be angry, because as the Rambam tells us, that's what we need to do to get our point across. It may well be that there are times when we need to be angry, because that's what it means to be a moral person, even if it's not effective at all, right? But simply recognize the injustice in the world. That may also be a time when it's important to be angry. And I want us to be highly aware of the cost, that every time we get angry, there's something pulling us back down that we need to take account of as we are thinking about that anger. So as we end part two of this, next week we're going to shift into thinking about ways to manage, transmute, I don't want to say sublimate, because it's not about getting rid of, but sort of transform and elevate our anger into something more, less dangerous, let's say. Even as we move towards that, I want to note both that there are times when we need to be angry and that that comes with a cost. Thank you, everyone. Hope to see you all back here next week as we think about ways to manage our anger and make it more ethical. Have a good night and a good week.